measures proposed by President Biden, but is working to ensure they protect and extend the use of coal and natural gas. He agrees with the president that communities dependent on fossil fuels deserve financial support as the country transitions to green energy. And he's a booster of carbon capture sequestration, a nascent technology that collects carbon emissions from smokestacks and buries them in the ground. If it were to become commercially viable, the technology could allow industries to continue to burn coal, oil, and gas. But the most powerful climate mechanism in the budget bill, and the one that Joe Manchin intends to reshape, is a $150 billion program designed to replace most of the nation's coal and gas-fired power plants with wind, solar, and nuclear power over the next decade. Known as the Clean Electricity Performance Program, it would pay utilities to ratchet up the amount of power they produce from zero-emission sources and fine those power stations that don't. As envisioned by the White House and House Democrats, the carrot-and-stick approach could transform the nation's electricity sector, the second-largest source of greenhouse pollution after transportation. The policy is crucial to President Biden's goal of producing 80% of electricity from zero-carbon sources by 2030 and 100% clean electricity by 2035, analysts say. It could also help lower pollution from automobiles, since electric cars and trucks would be drawing power from a grid powered by clean energy. This policy is an essential foundation for rapidly reducing emissions in the most polluting sectors of the economy, said Richard Newell, president of Resources for the Future, a nonpartisan energy and environmental research organization. Joe Manchin's version is widely expected to have less ambitious renewable energy requirements for electricity power companies. His version could also reward utilities that build new power plants designed to burn natural gas. While it emits about half the carbon dioxide of coal, natural gas is still a major contributor to global warming.
Ministry.
Washington and its delegates in Lebanon, the last of whom was a delegation of the U.S. Senate Foreign Affairs Committee, know that Hezbollah's decision is a major breach of the U.S. undeclared sanctions against Lebanon and a major break of the embargo imposed on adopting alternatives that strictly fall within the American-approved basket of options. However, the Americans view the situation from another angle and are more attached to their grand project, especially to Lebanon, which is adjacent to occupied Palestine and thus to Israel's higher interests. The Americans see that Sayed Nasrallah's last decision has moved Hezbollah from a position of steadfastness in the face of U.S. siege policies and pressures to a position of direct confrontation. And in this position, the Americans take into account the resistance's intention and willingness to reach far in this confrontation. Meanwhile, this transition for Washington means that its tools in Lebanon, whether traditional or even civil society institutions that are known as NGOs, are at stake. Neither are they able to confront the resistance in its decision to confront the American blockade, nor are they able to support it, which deepens the predicament they fell into since Sayed Nasrallah announced in his speech on the 10th of Muharram the launch of the first fuel ships to break the siege of Lebanon. Hezbollah's decision re-emphasized the importance of Syria in relation to Lebanon, as well as to the axis of resistance. This pushed the U.S. administration through its ambassador in Beirut to hastily announce its intention and readiness to lift part of its sanctions and siege on Syria imposed under the Caesars Act to open the way for electricity and gas from Jordan and Egypt to Lebanon through Syrian territories, obliging an American affirmation of Syria's value and position in relation to Lebanon. The choice of the United States to accept competition with Hezbollah instead of confronting it comes at a historic moment for it in light of its ongoing defeat in Afghanistan, while the Naftali Bennett government in occupied Palestine is left with nothing but trouble after the American withdrawal by activating its aggression raids against Syria. This new situation makes it imperative for the Lebanese state to open up to Syria and provides it with the appropriate opportunity to do so. On the Lebanese side, Hezbollah's major decision puts any future government in front of a fait accompli that will not be able to skip. The designated Prime Minister Najib Mikati tried to gain more time to bypass the arrival of fuel ships. However, the fact that the ships arrived in Syria instead of Lebanon can be considered a kind of a settlement that preserves the faces of the Lebanese state and its institutions, as well as the facts created by the decision in terms of prompting the U.S. administration to stand in line to try to solve Lebanon's economic crisis. Hezbollah has always dealt with great caution with the internal situation in order to avoid conflict with its opponents and allies alike. Today, however, Hezbollah stands at the center of a new equation of confrontation with the United States directly. Hezbollah knows that this battle is inseparable from the main battle related to preserving the resistance, its role, legitimacy, and position, even if it differs in form. Today, however, Hezbollah is preparing for the arrival of the first Iranian ship loaded with petroleum products to declare the fifth victory this time against U.S. hegemony. After the liberation in 2000 and the July 2006 victory against Israel, the Arsal victory against Takfiri terrorists in 2017, and the victory against Western and Wahhabi-funded terrorists inside Syria. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Iranian ship loaded with fuel, which Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah announced on the 10th day of Muharram that it set off from Iran and that its final cargo destination will be Lebanon, entered Syrian territorial waters last week. According to the Al-Akhbar Lebanese Daily, the cargo of the ship will be transported by tankers from Syria to Lebanon after unloading it at the Syrian port of Banias. Now, Al-Akhbar newspaper also stated that the part of the ship's cargo will be donated by Hezbollah to government hospitals and care homes. Now, experts believe that this move will actually increase Hezbollah's popularity both inside and outside Lebanon for taking the initiative to save the Lebanese people from hardships while also defending the country's sovereignty and dignity. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut right here is Dr. Tim Anderson, academic, author, and general coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance in Australia. Dr. Tim, thank you for being with us in Beirut. Now, practically, the U.S. does not care about the welfare of the Lebanese people. They only concern about weakening Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance. If stability achieves this kind of weakening, they will go with stability. If actual chaos achieves this, they will go with chaos. They don't care. But now a convoy of Iranian fuel ship has been ordered by Hezbollah to arrive to Lebanon through Syria, which is breaking both internal monopoly and American hegemony and sanctions against both Lebanon and Syria at the same time. How do you think the U.S. will react to this, or actually is reacting right now to this?
Well, thank you. The first reaction is, of course, they've rapidly tried to mobilize some alternative energy streams. Whether that's going to materialize in the near future is not clear, but that was to do with the idea of getting some energy from Jordan and from Egypt going through Syria. So that was the first stage. Apart from that, I think it's very difficult for the US to do things openly. They really want to preserve the image of themselves as a savior of the region, and that's why it's a game of trying to put the blame on the resistance and trying to avoid the blame themselves. So they have to move quite carefully in the current circumstances, because everyone in this country knows the problem with fuel, and everyone is going to welcome any move to break that blockade.
Well, including breaking the U.S. being itself breaking its own law against Syria. How do you think about that?
Well, the U.S. law, which we should not call sanctions, by the way, they're unilateral coercive measures. They're against Lebanon and against Syria and against Iran, but there have always been these type of exceptions where through the grace and favour of the Secretary of the Treasury in the U.S., they can grant exemptions to people particularly for the third-party sanctions, which are the things that are most operative here there. So the US can manipulate these sorts of rules as it suits, as we know, and really it'll do it to try and maintain its image in the region, which is, of course, suffering greatly for a range of reasons at the moment.
Well, Iran has proved to be a great friend and ally to all countries in the region, but specifically here, Syria and Lebanon, which fall under the banner of the Axis of Resistance in West Asia. But this time, the Iranian move not only positively affected Lebanon, but also it affected Syria, which saw the first visit by an official Lebanese delegation from the government, despite the fact it's in the resigning government here, but still it's the official delegation, after this Iranian ship also was announced. What made the U.S. allow those government officials to finally visit Damascus? And I'm saying allow because one of the ministers actually said that. He said the U.S. allowed us to do this. What made them allow them to do this and break this Caesar's Act against, basically it was against anyone who deals with the Syrian government. And now they are pushing the Lebanese government to go deal with the Syrian government.
Yes, it's a peculiar word which comes up from time to time, allow, isn't it? And it would be very strange in any other country if we spoke of a government getting permission from some government on the other side of the world to do things, to talk to their neighbours in particular. And of course that's the rub here, that Lebanon has only one land trading border, and that is with Syria. So therefore the alternative options that were proposed by the US representative here and her masters were that these potential energy sources, if they are to materialise, would have to come in some way through Syria. So therefore I think that's why the US granted permission to the representatives of the Lebanese government to visit their neighbour.
Yeah, might I remind or maybe give an info to our audience that half, if not more than half, the ministers of this government and potentially the upcoming government as well already have U.S. passports. So by all means, this is a chaotic scene in Lebanon. But all that the Biden administration today wants from Lebanon is to inflict the greatest possible harm against Hezbollah. And I'm not saying this, it's the Biden administration who keeps saying this at every time and every chance they get. And it never asks or cares about the fate or the future of the Lebanese people, even about the fate and the future of its own assets and supposedly allies in Lebanon, whether it's political parties, associations, NGOs, you name it. However, Hezbollah's move restored a lot of popularity amongst amongst different areas in Lebanon where they are usually considered anti-resistance areas. People started saying, no, we accept what Hezbollah is doing. That broke a lot of the U.S. plans inside of Lebanon. Would that push the U.S. to end Lebanon's security stability, despite the fact that it's not really good right now, the security, but it's still holding it together?
Well, it's already been undermining Lebanon's security for some time. It's not going to be happy with the fact that the solutions to a lot of Lebanon's problems are going to be better relations with their neighbours. This is not rocket science, but unfortunately it's something that the big powers have done from the beginning, haven't they? They divided the Levant up into different groups. They divided Lebanon into different confessional groups and so on. They created these sorts of systems, and they specialise in dividing people and keeping them fragmented and weak. And of course, the reverse applies, that the solutions for stability and for energy security, amongst other things, have to be greater cooperation, particularly with neighbours.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will continue talking about this matter and about the role of the U.S. in stopping a lot of developing plans and a lot of positive plans for Lebanon since actually before the civil war and later on after this plague. Please stay tuned. We will continue talking to Dr. Tim Anderson about the matter of the Iranian fuel ships going and on its way to Beirut.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts.
Now, in a statement before leaving the Lebanese cabinet, capital, Beirut, the Democratic senator in the U.S. Congress, Richard Blumenthal, and considered that Hezbollah is a rampant cancer that must be eradicated only because the resistance decided to ask its allies for help to rid Lebanon from this fuel crisis. Yes, you heard that right. A foreign member of Congress of a country 10,000 kilometers away from my country had the audacity not only to comment on Lebanese internal affairs, but also made sure to attack the largest and most powerful political bloc and resistance faction in the region. In a statement from Beirut International Airport, Blumenthal then stressed that Lebanon should not rely on Iran to solve its crisis, especially via the fuel ship, stressing that the U.S. administration is actively working to solve the fuel crisis. Yeah, sure. Iranian fuel ships bound for Lebanon exposes U.S. role in fuel crisis in this following report.
At every political pit stop in Lebanon, the old problem of securing electricity and energy in the country resurfaces. Several times, this crisis came close to taking the path to a solution before it collided with various obstacles, setting back the clock by years or even decades. This allowed the nurture of a system that constitutes one of the biggest sources of financial waste, whether for the public treasury or for the foreign currency reserves of the Lebanese Central Bank. Years of incompetence and corruption have brought the energy sector to what it is today, and for the most part, it was intended either to secure the sustainability of the profits of owners of the most expensive private generators that illegally filled the hours of power outage of the state-provided electricity, or in order to block the way for people working to solve the problem so that said people do not appear alone as saviors while others were failures. However, little does the world knows about the role of the United States of America in bringing the situation of the electricity sector in Lebanon to its current terrible state. It is, of course, not a conspiracy theory, as many people claim when they hear the smallest word criticizing their favorite empire. The role of the United States in the electricity crisis starts from the top of the pyramid, that is, from the nature of its system as well as the Lebanese economic system, which is a microcosm of its American counterpart, despite the nature of the relationship between both countries, which can be described as commander-slash-subordinate one. The pillars of the capitalist system depend on making profits, regardless of the environmental, social, economic, health, and human costs, as well as on the exploitation of resources, especially those belonging to weak countries, and the exclusion of everything that might affect the interest of large merchants, large companies, financiers, and the deep state in America. This explains the dependence of the greater part of the world to this day on non-renewable energy, such as oil, gas, coal, etc., to provide electricity and bear its high costs on the planet and its inhabitants, whether it is health, financial, environmental, or human, despite the capacity of renewable energy like the sun, wind, and water to provide many times as much energy as the entire world needs. This American control happens through wars. Without imperialism, the American capitalist system will not be upright, or by imposing economic systems that suit the interests of the United States and its companies using various means, most notably international organizations such as the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. The United States wages military and economic wars on countries that have a huge stock of resources and countries that have huge global reserves, such as Iraq, Libya, Venezuela, Iran, and Bolivia, who are astonishingly suffering from electricity crisis. Lebanon is one of those countries, in addition to it being one of the countries in the region over which the Zionist entity makes sure to have leverage over, even if by force. Hence why, in its wars against Lebanon, Israel always targeted energy production plants, fuel tanks, and other energy requirements with the support and patronage of the Americans and the complicity of American assets in Lebanon, whose role in the July 2006 aggression was exposed by WikiLeaks.
Now we continue from Beirut with Dr. Tim Anderson, academic, author, and general coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance in Australia. Tim, donor institutions and state institutions or state donors as well, they place conditions on countries that are considered destructive to their economy, which is what happened in Lebanon and posed a deficit in the state budget as well as the Lebanese energy sector. And it is intended to happen again by the U.S. calling for the IMF to interfere in Lebanon. Thus, we're talking about the Lebanese economy that reached a complete collapse and the production of mainly poor electricity. was automatically affected in our country. All this is directly dictated by the United States of America. Would that be enough for Hezbollah to expand its now new project from getting fuel for the Lebanese people to actually completely solving the energy problem in Lebanon with the help of its allies in West Asia?
I think what you've said is going to happen gradually, step by step, and no doubt it's unpalatable to the big power that this means increased cooperation between Lebanon, Syria, and Iran. I don't think it's going to happen all at once. I think there's no need for other possible options in terms of sources of energy to be developed. But as we know, Hezbollah has a very good credit rating with Iran, a very good credit rating, and it's going to be a very competitive source of energy as it develops, as you've said, coming through Banyas and perhaps being refined there and shipped down into Lebanon. So it's an important first step, but let's see what other options are. It's good for Lebanon if there's a number of different options there. It would be a much more difficult thing for energy security if there were dependence on simply one source of energy.
Well, the issue here is, what if Hezbollah decides to go eco-friendly and get something that benefits Lebanon without actually further damaging our environment? With fuel ships, they went crazy. What would they do if we completely get rid of the use of oil or gas for electricity?
Well, if there are viable alternatives, I mean, that remains to be seen. I'm not sure to what extent that's the case now. There's extreme shortages, and in the short term, I think there's going to be take some time to wean people off the addiction of this diesel and benzene.
Well, the most dangerous thing is that some foreign parties will use their companies and they will take advantage of the current situation in Lebanon to market their desire to invest in new power plants, and their goal will only be to ensure that Lebanon depends on them, is always dependent on them, at least in the energy sector, to say the least. Thus, the United States is benefiting from the electricity crisis in Lebanon, just like in Latin America, for example, where the countries under U.S. sanctions and hegemony, they have great resources. They have a huge amount of resources, yet they are controlled by the U.S. Can a regional West Asian economic and infrastructure alliance be able to confront this form of neocolonialism? And if so, in what ways do you think it is possible? Not only in energy, what else?
Well, on the first part of your question, I think it's natural that there's going to be some private initiatives to fill the gap, because there's a terrible need now. The country is very desperate, and there are huge queues all around for fuel. So I think those private initiatives are natural and necessary in some ways. The danger is there's going to be some inefficiency in developing projects which may not proceed. In terms of the second part of your question, I think it's absolutely essential that this neighbourly cooperation, the development of regional cooperation in infrastructure, energy, in commerce, in finance, in a range of things, develops much further. I think it's really the only medium-term to long-term solution for stability in the energy sector and many other sectors.
Well, Timon, it's wars against Lebanon. We have seen throughout history the Israeli entity targeting energy production facilities and fuel tanks and other infrastructure that are very important for any city in the world, with the support and sponsorship, obviously, of the Americans, and the complicity of American assets inside of Lebanon, which was revealed by WikiLeaks after 2006. Will Israel truly just stay put, stay silent when all of this is happening? Will they abide by the new deterrence equation which was raised by Hezbollah to protect the Iranian fuel ships bound for Lebanon? Said Nasrallah was very obvious. He said, these ships are now Lebanese land. What do you think?
Well, we have to look at the current anxiety levels of the Israelis. They are very concerned, particularly with the recent collapse of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. I think the collaborators of the U.S., particularly in their destabilization wars and proxy wars around the region, all looked at Kabul Airport and feared it was them falling from those planes, basically. There was apparently a wave of emigration from the Kurdish separatists in the north of Syria. They were despairing that what's going to happen when the U.S. pulls out of there. So the Israelis fear that. They're concerned about that, and I think that's why Bennett went recently to Washington to get some sort of assurances. The Israelis are always looking for some sorts of assurances that if something blows up, if Iran decides finally, for example, to respond to one of the many provocations, or if Syria decides to respond to one of the many provocations and attacks that are carried out, they want to be some sort of guarantee that the U.S. is going to back them up.
Well, American and Israeli wars in Lebanon, they completely destroyed the energy sector, but the war on Syria also harmed the Lebanese economy, given that this is the only land border that we have. Because the Zionist occupation, Lebanon has no other outlet except for Syria because of this occupation. Through Syria, we used to export to Iraq and to the other Persian Gulf countries and to Central Asia as well in certain products. But now, we can't even export anything, and we can't even import electricity or fuel from them. The borders were closed to any kind of interaction, and the relationship between the two countries almost became severe until last week, as we said, when the first official Lebanese delegation actually visited Damascus. We are witnessing a lot of change in the empire's behavior in the post-Afghanistan withdrawal era. Are the days of the empire numbered in West Asia, as its enemies would like to say, or is it just too early to be talking in this manner or in this tone?
I think there is a movement in that direction. There has been a discussion in Washington for some years about a strategic withdrawal from the region. You recall when Trump was campaigning 5 years ago, he was talking about withdrawing from Syria and Iraq. He made some moves, but was countermanded by other forces in the so-called deep state. Same with Afghanistan. Now, for some time, the Saudis have been trying to get some sort of ceasefire in Yemen. So they know that they're losing. They've been losing for some years. And that affects the way they see the whole big picture.
Well, it does affect it, but there's something very important that we need to remind our audience about: their presence in Iraq and how complicated it is for the Americans to actually withdraw from Iraq the same way they did in Afghanistan. But what would really push them to leave at this moment, and what would be the other option that would push them to stay?
Well, it's been enunciated by one of the officials at the end of the Trump administration, a man called McGregor, who said that he thought they should withdraw from the areas in which they were losing and consolidate in the areas which they considered their key interests, that is to say Israel, Jordan, some of the Gulf monarchies, for example. A strategic partial withdrawal from the region, because even though they can keep fighting a losing war to try and punish the people who have defeated them, there are some limits to that. And they've been losing in Syria for 6 years now, for example. So I think the occupations in Syria and Iraq are likely to collapse together.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, they're still paranoid about this. It doesn't mean they are not concerned. They're not going to try and undermine in other ways
mm-hmm.
Afghanistan, but also what's often spoken of as an Iranian land bridge. If you look at intelligence circles in Israel and the US, they talk about an Iranian land bridge as a great fear. That is to say, you have infrastructure networks from Iran across to the Mediterranean, effectively.
Mm-hmm.
But that, of course, would be a great thing for the economic development of the region. This region is backward because it's been so divided, because it's been so smashed up, and those sorts of neighbourly cooperation projects are the things that are really going to provide a step out of this terrible situation.
Well, it seems that we're going to have a very interesting end of 2021 and a beginning of a new 2022, where the presence of the Americans is very unstable in the region of West Asia. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Tim Anderson, author, academic, and general coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance in Australia. Thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned for more from the Middle East next week.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
the limelight.
One of the seven Republican senators who voted to convict Donald Trump at his second impeachment trial warned on Sunday, 19th of September, that the former president's bullying of the party would lead to electoral defeat in next year's midterms and beyond. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian columnist Richard Luscombe. The piece is titled, "Republicans Who Let Trump Bully Party Will Seal Midterms Defeat," Senator says. One of seven Republican senators who voted to convict Donald Trump at his second impeachment trial warned on Sunday, 19th of September, that the former president's bullying of the party would lead to electoral defeat in next year's midterm elections and beyond. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana was speaking days after the Ohio Republican Congressman Anthony Gonzalez, who voted to impeach Trump over the U.S. Capitol attack, announced he would not seek re-election. On Saturday, 18th of September, another Trump critic in the House, Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, released a hard-hitting video statement in which he told colleagues, silent about the state of their party, the time for hiding is over. Republican Senator Bill Cassidy told NBC's Meet the Press, "Politicians are not victims. Politicians make a choice. If we choose to look forward, bringing positive solutions to the American people who have needs, we win. If we choose to be bullied, we lose." The two-term senator also appeared to reference an extraordinary letter sent this week by Donald Trump to the Georgia Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, demanding he decertify the illegitimate presidential election result. Joe Biden's win in Georgia is central to Donald Trump's big lie that the election was stolen. His previous efforts to overturn the result are the subject of a criminal inquiry. The broader question, frankly, is do Republicans continue to re-litigate 2020, or do we look forward with a positive agenda? Bill Cassidy said, "If we re-litigate 2020 over and over again, it won't change the result in 2020, but we're sure to lose in 2024. On the other hand, if we have a positive agenda which addresses the fact that the Biden administration is in disarray, whether it's inflation, the border, Afghanistan, then the country will win and will win. But if we choose to be bullied, we'll lose." Allies of Donald Trump have said they expect him to run for the White House again. Bill Cassidy's vote to convict him would have disqualified the former president from running for office again. It brought a fierce backlash from members of his own party and Donald Trump himself. But the Louisiana senator does not face re-election himself until 2026. Others who have spoken out have felt the wrath of Donald Trump and his acolytes, including Liz Cheney, the Wyoming congresswoman ousted as number three Republican in the House after voting for Donald Trump's impeachment, and also Anthony Gonzalez. Anthony Gonzalez, a 37-year-old former NFL player, said he was standing down to spend more time with his family. But he acknowledged that toxic dynamics inside his own party was also a significant factor. In a New York Times interview, Anthony Gonzalez said Donald Trump was a cancer for our country, whom he did not believe could ever be president again. He also dismissed Donald Trump's inevitable good riddance response, voiced in a statement on Friday. "I haven't cared what he says or thinks since 6th of January, outside when he continues to lie about the election, which I have a problem with," Anthony Gonzalez said. Senator Bill Cassidy would not be drawn on whether Gonzalez's departure was good or bad for the Republican Party. Anthony is choosing his personal priorities. You read his statement, it stands for itself, he said. But he stressed that the GOP was in dire need of a new direction. We answer to voters, and so if we don't answer to voters in a positive way, we lose, he said. If all you do is talk about the past, then you're yesterday's news. Meanwhile, the former Democratic Congressman Beto O'Rourke is set to mount a third campaign for major political office with a run for governor of Texas, according to the Axios website on Sunday. Citing unnamed Texas political operatives, the website Axios said Beto O'Rourke's challenge to the Republican Governor Greg Abbott would be announced later this year. A longtime advisor, David Weissong, told Axios, no decision has been made, but also said O'Rourke had been making and receiving calls with people all over the state. The Hollywood actor Matthew McConaughey has also flirted with challenge to Greg Abbott, a hardline Republican who recently stoked liberal outrage by signing into law new voting restrictions in Texas and the most severe abortion law in the country. Some Democrats fear a centrist run from Hollywood actor Matthew McConaughey could divide the anti-Abbott vote. Gilberto Hinojosa, chair of the state Democratic Party, told Axios website, we hope O'Rourke is going to run. We think he'll be our strongest candidate. We think he can beat Abbott. The 48-year-old Beto O'Rourke served three terms in the U.S. House from an El Paso district before resigning to run for Senate in 2018. Republican Governor Greg Abbott is running for a third term in office but looks vulnerable, particularly after presiding over a deadly failure of the state energy grid during a cold snap in February this year and opposing measures to combat COVID-19. Nearly 62,000 Texans have died.
A simple question.
It seems that everyone knew the Taliban would retake Afghanistan when the Americans left. That is, everyone apart from Washington and Westminster. Even though America announced 18 months previously that it planned to leave, the British Foreign Minister, that's Dominic Raab, appears to have been taken completely by surprise by the events that followed.
Commentators point to the disastrous withdrawal of British forces, civilians and allies as evidence that the Foreign Office had no real clue about how to deal with a rapid Taliban advance. In an ironic parody of the successful Dunkirk evacuation in World War II, Mr. Raab had no proper plan for the Afghanistan evacuation, even though anybody watching recent news reports could see what was going to happen. The situation may have been made even worse by the embarrassing discovery that the Foreign Secretary was on holiday out of the country, for the Taliban were taking one over. The UK and USA are now locked in a bitter war of words about the catastrophic military defeat suffered by both countries. Both have lost personnel, money and credibility in this strategic implosion. Many members of the public say that Dominic Raab's poor performance has added to the humiliation in another damaging blow to the credibility of the United Kingdom, which once commanded half the world and now can't even command an evacuation.
Does it matter that the Foreign Secretary was on holiday when Afghanistan fell? And how does the public view the current blame game between Westminster and Washington? Simple questions with important answers. And let's start with this. What does the public think about the military disaster suffered by the United Kingdom and the United States in Afghanistan? That's what we asked the public here in London. This is what they said.
I think they could have done it better, really, because we've spent so long, 20 years, for, you know, and we haven't really helped anybody. We haven't really helped the Afghan people either. They've just been left to suffer, really.
It's awful. I mean, people are dying. We've fought with them, well, with America to look after the Afghan people, and it's just gone, it's all gone wrong. What's the point of us trying to help them if they're going to pull out and leave people there to die and suffer? So
it never should have happened. We all should have, like, helped out, and we should have never left. Because, I mean, it would probably affect us in the long run, but what's now done is done, and it's all the soldiers that are left, like, injured and stuff.
Well, it's an absolute disaster. Absolute mess. Shambles. And Raab should be kicked out on his backside. Never mind pretending and saying he's been doing this and that. He's absolutely hopeless. And Boris, he needs to be kicked as well, between the ghoulies. It's an absolute shambles. And Biden, Americans, what did he expect the Taliban to do? He leaves the country undefended. He's been fighting it for 20 years, and he hasn't won that war. And he didn't go say, OK, walk in, do whatever you want, and then say, oh, we didn't expect this to happen. We didn't expect this to happen. Oh, we didn't expect it to happen so quickly. Absolute idiots. Absolute idiots. It's disaster, really. And I feel sorry for Afghanistan people, because they've done no wrong. They expected protection from the British, the American, the foreign forces, and they just haven't got it. They've been badly let down. Absolutely betrayed.
I think it was absolutely terrible, really. I think there should have been a little bit more time, because all the people that actually worked for the British government never got a chance to get out, you know. So that's what I think. They should have been allowed a little bit more time, because there's going to be a hell of a lot of lives that may be taken purely because they work for the British government or the American government. Do you know what I mean? So it's good.
We shouldn't have gone in there if we was just going to pull out like that, because the Taliban had just taken over there anyway. So what was the point in the first place?
I think what I make of it is it's just a shame. It's an absolute shame. And the more I look into it and read more about it, research it, I do think we've actually walked away and left a lot of people there that actually deserved our help and support. And I feel a bit ashamed that we just left them to their own devices, if I'm completely honest.
I think it's really sad, and I think we spent a long time over there, and it's a shame that we've all now gone back to how it was.
I think it's good we've got our troops over there, but it's good we've got them out as well, isn't it? You know. We seem to be the country that is first in line to get involved with these things. We're a really small country, you know.
Yeah, I think it is. Obviously, withdrawing after all this time, I think it's the timing of it all that probably makes people most upset.
I think it was very unplanned. I think they planned it very well, Afghanistan themselves, but I feel like making it public that America was going to leave Afghanistan, it took them 14 months to move in. It was 14 months of planning. It's just very unorganised.
And I think it's atrocious of everything that's happened. I think the amount of innocent lives that have been lost due to such issues that have happened is absolutely appalling. And I think the way that both countries could have gone about it could have been a lot better, a lot more organised in it, and a lot more, like, clean in the way that they've, like, pushed towards actually trying to help. They were a bit lazy, in my opinion, on it. They kind of just took, like, too much time where they could have actually helped a lot more people get out.
Hundreds or perhaps thousands of British personnel, civilians and allies were left behind in the chaos in Afghanistan. What's the British public's opinion about this remarkable outcome?
It's not fair. They could have given fair enough warning. Like, they must have known that something, like, they would have done it. They must have known that they were pulling their troops out way before they did. They must have known. So to not have helped and given them the support that they needed is just wrong, really.
I think it's atrocious. We had over a year to get everybody out. We had over a year to plan. And I know we've trained Afghanistan troops, but it just didn't work out the way we planned at all.
I don't know. I think it's weakness on our part, perhaps on the American side as well. And I think it is unforgivable. It's going to be difficult, I think, if they're going to be having to go back to Afghanistan. I think they want to avoid that now, of course. But, yeah, I feel very much for those people, of course. Tragic.
I just think it's just so sad. Just so sad. And
disorganised.
Disorganised as well. And I know we got bought into it, but it was just totally disorganised. Don't want to get too positive, but I always think leaders should always get left behind.
Left it too late. I honestly do think we should have done things before. It should have been. We knew this was going to be happening. I mean, I can remember the interpreters saying quite some time ago that they were at risk. So we were too slow. Too slow. That's why, yeah.
I mean, it's a difficult one because obviously, you have an entire population that are wanting to escape Afghanistan. And the difficulty that the government had is that obviously the American forces, the president put a deadline on when America would be pulling out. And it just wasn't possible for us to stay without that support. So, you know, the government's hands were very much tied by what President Biden did.
Well, obviously, it's criminal, isn't it, almost? I don't know what the criteria is for getting out, whether there was a criteria, or what numbers were allowed to get out, etc. Again, what do you do with the people being left behind that have got legal rights to come to the UK? Do we go back in and sort those out? I'm not a military commander, so I don't know the answer to those questions.
Because we didn't plan well enough, and I think the Taliban probably took people by surprise, which is how so quick. Although I'm not sure they did take them by surprise, but there you go.
Well, you say that, but I think at the end of the day, I don't think we realise how much the Taliban would take back control. Well, I think the biggest thing is the fact that, if you listen to Joe Biden, that there was 300,000 trained Afghanistan army, and what happened to them? Where did they go?
The British Foreign Secretary, Dominic Raab, was on holiday when the collapse of the UK-US-led presence in Afghanistan occurred. But does that matter to the public?
Well, we're all entitled to holidays, aren't we? And I don't think for one minute he would have made any difference whatsoever, whether he was in Greece, wherever he was, on a beach with a towel, whatever. That'd make no difference whatsoever. At that time it was happening. A phone call wasn't going to make a jot of difference.
I don't think it's, I mean, to be honest, I think the media like to stoke up an awful lot more, what was happening. You'd have probably, things happened 20 years ago, but I think the sort of scrutiny that politicians get these days, it's very much, it's amplified. I think the government, they did the best to try and work with what they got during that short time frame.
Well, did he really know what was going on behind the scenes? I mean, he went on holiday. He's got a lot of flack from it. But I think at the end of the day, like you say, they're entitled to a holiday. And I presume that he had understaff that would also take control a little bit about it and go for there, really. I mean, you can't blame him in one respect. But I know they've got taken said that he took the eye off the ball, but... we all make mistakes, and it just goes to show that we're only human. Everyone's human, aren't we?
Well,
people go on holiday.
People do go on holiday, to be fair, but the timing wasn't great, I suppose. It is holiday season. The timing's not great, but I think they were caught unawares, to be honest with you.
Honestly, I'm not sure about the details, so I'm not quite sure exactly how many people have been left behind. I read that there's many people left behind, but I haven't seen the facts. So,
I think that is absolutely unforgivable. I was reading it in the paper the other day, and you can't do that. With such an important role, you can't really be jetting off to the Mediterranean Sea and having a nice holiday. So, yeah, I think you job should really be on the line as a result of what's happened, for sure.
Not so much unlucky. Again, it's a bit timing strange, isn't it, when it all happened, and to be away at that sort of time, that crucial moment, is a bit odd, yeah.
It's obviously not great, it's not ideal. I do think that mistakes have been made, no doubt about it, but I also do think that the mass media have played up to this in a degree by focusing on that and not really focusing on the other hundreds of staff members that he's got that were doing the job as well. So it wasn't great. He should have come back. But there again, he's only human. But he should have had the intelligence network behind him to say that something was in the offing that was going to go wrong. So
I think it's not surprising because it's just it's anarchy, isn't it, in Afghanistan. So I think it's very difficult to discern how many people are actually there and have been left behind.
Absolute rubbish. Yeah, he's on holiday, but he has to make a call. You get off your backside and you make the call. Then you go back and relax or do whatever you want to do. But make that call. There's no excuses. Undefensible. He should be kicked out, as I said. He should be in office. And there's no honour amongst these MPs anymore. I think in the days in Parliament, if the members didn't have no confidence or honour in the Speaker or whoever's speaking, they'd turn their backs on them. I think they used to do that, didn't they? And no one's doing that. They should have done that to Danny Ryan. He should be out on his ear. He shouldn't be speaking for Britain. He's an absolute disgrace. Absolute disgrace.
It's the type of job where, whether you're on holiday or not, you pick up the phone and you are there to make sure your people and anyone else you're there to help gets out and is safe. It's not the type of job where you can go, I can leave it to next week and, you know, forget a few emails. You have to, you know, you have to be there to help them and support them, so...
The statistics of the war tell a grim story of vast expense, poor planning, and even worse outcomes. The cost of the war has been estimated at £39 billion to the UK. And in the 20 years of the conflict, over 450 service personnel have lost their lives. Now, as the war ends in British and American defeat, 17,000 people have been evacuated by the United Kingdom alone. However, the number of people left behind is unknown and could be thousands. The United States and the United Kingdom have been blaming each other for the poor exit strategy. But who does the public blame for that chaotic withdrawal from Afghanistan?
Both. They're both as bad as each other, really. They should have just put the people first. That's all it comes down to. It doesn't matter about bigwigs or Parliament or anything. It's just about the people. We need to help the people, and there's people struggling, so they're both to blame. They're both as bad as each other.
Everyone that was out there trying to fight, they should have all stayed out there, help bring people home. It's sort of their mess in the long term.
I blame the Americans, really, to be honest. Britain only followed Americans' example, right? If they're getting people out, you know, they shouldn't have gave a deadline to get the people out at the end of August, the 31st of August, everybody has to be out of the country. Britain had no choice, they had to go, because they would have been left on their own, and most probably even a bigger target, you know, because they didn't have the backing of the Americans. So the Americans, they shouldn't have got out so quickly. It should have been allowed more time. And most probably, like the French government, they started taking their people out in May and June and things like that sort of stuff. Maybe we should have done the same thing ourselves.
I think my blame for the way it's turned out in the end game would go towards the Americans, because they just pulled out too quickly. But there again, I can see it from their side, because they've actually carried the bulk of the responsibility for this campaign for, you know, 20-odd years. And it's all very well for the rest of us to sort of sit back and say, oh, the Americans did this, Americans did that. But perhaps if the other nations in Europe, say, for example, like ourselves, Germany, France, had actually committed more resources and done our fair share, then perhaps the Americans wouldn't have walked away so quickly.
I think you've got to blame both. They've both got a presence over there, so, you know, they should be working together, really.
America, definitely. I mean, President Trump was the first to say that America would be pulling out of Afghanistan, and then you had Joe Biden during his campaign said that he would pursue that, he would take the American troops out. He then put a deadline on it, and, you know, American intelligence clearly wasn't what it needed to be, because they were taken by surprise. And to be honest, I think the comments that the president made when he blamed the Afghan government and the president, you know, they weren't perfect by any means, but to throw that blame, I thought, was horrific, to be quite frank. And I think if America had the parliamentary system that we do over in Britain, I think that they'd be looking at having a new president.
Oh, crikey, both to blame, I think. Yeah, it's all been a bit of a nightmare situation, hasn't it, for both countries? I think it's not looking good at all for both.
I don't think you can blame one country. I think it's a communal sort of, you know, effort, and I don't know whether there's any sort of EU soldiers still out there that can control things. I don't know. Working with the Taliban has got to be a must, hasn't it, now? Whether you can work with the Taliban, time will tell.
Probably America at the moment, because they're the ones most communication with the Taliban, and have really prompted the withdrawal, and then we've sort of jumped on the back of that to get ours out very quickly.
I think everyone's got to take their share of the blame. I mean, it's no for tit for tat arguing amongst themselves. We were a coalition sort of force. NATO, I think, have been a very quiet over the whole affair. I don't think it seems to me that the Americans and the British are always the ones that take the blame. But that I suppose that's to be decided, really.
The UK have had to follow the US lead. I mean, they we're there to support them effectively. So in that sense, I think it has to fall squarely on Joe Biden, I'm afraid, and I think he's done an extremely bad job. And again, you've got to question his position, unfortunately.
I think it's both. Always in times of war or anything that's to do with like political issues and everything, they always blame each other because they don't want to take the responsibility of the actions of that has happened, and you don't want to take the blame for anything that happened. And I think both should take like responsibility for everything that's happened, and it is both like parties' fault. And I don't think war should ever happen again. I think too many lives, and it's too many people who are in higher power that are taking the role of like choosing and dictating of what should happen.
Well, I blame politics, but probably it was America really that, or the organisation of it. So probably America I would blame that thing, and also with the administration in America, really.
There's one more key question. Next time the UK is asked to assist the US in a war, what does the public want the British response to be?
I think we should be very careful not to jump into any conflicts. War is the final. That should always be the last decision. You never want to go to war, and if we were going to go to war, then it should be, you know, try to pursue peace where there is conflict. I think if America does decide that there's a new conflict on the rise and asks us to join, then let's think very hard about it.
Make our own decisions and step back and see what our interests, our country's interests are first. Are we just supporting our special friend, or is there an actual benefit to our country? You know, do we have nationals there and so forth?
If it's justified, we should do it. They are our biggest friends. I don't care what anyone else says, but they are. And if needs be, we'll defend whatever we need to defend, I think. I appreciate we're not as big as we used to be. We're only a small country, but I still like to think that we are powerful enough in appreciation to all the armed forces that we've had, the loss of life, etc., and things like that. And I mean, at the end of the day, if we have to go back to war somewhere to defend the rights of people, if we're able to do so, I think we should do so.
Definitely no. Why should we? They didn't leave us any notice to get out. They just left us stranded there, and no, wrong.
Absolutely not, because it's just there's no point. We shouldn't be their shadow. We should just do our own thing, really, and we shouldn't be getting in their petty quarrels. That's pretty much what it is. It's petty quarrels that we're getting caused into, that they started because they want to be getting their own things to themselves. They want to be more powerful, but it's not about that anymore. It's just about what's the right thing to do, especially in the economy and global crisis as well.
No. No, with a big capital no, because, you know, we got people, we lost over 450 people in that war, and if you see the news reports about some of those people that are in wheelchairs or lost arms, legs, limbs, loved ones, you know, their sons, daughters, you know, husbands, wives, everything, you know, it's an awful lot. And those people that are left behind picking up all the pieces for that, thinking, what the hell did I do this for? This is Vietnam all over again, as far as I'm concerned. Do you know what I mean? It's... you know, it's a very, very sad way of life and things like that sort of stuff. So, no.